morning tally, drawing a line for each day on the walls of a cell, because not a day had passed that something did not happen to remind him of her. At the time of their separation, he lived with his mother, Tránsito Arisa, in one half of a rented house on the Street of Windows, where she had kept a notions shop ever since she was a young woman, and where she also unraveled shirts and old rags to sell as bandages for the men wounded in the war. He was her only child, born of an occasional alliance with the well-known shipowner Don Pius V Loaysa, one of the three brothers who had founded the River Company of the Caribbean, and thereby given new impetus to steam navigation along the Magdalena River. Don Pius V Loaysa died when his son was 10 years old. Although he always took care of his expenses in secret, he never recognized him as his son before the law, nor did he leave him with his future secure, so that Florentino Arisa used only his mother's name, even though his true parentage was always common knowledge. Florentino Arisa had to leave school after his father's death, and he went to work as an apprentice in the postal agency, where he was in charge of opening sacks, sorting the letters, and notifying the public that mail had arrived by flying the flag of its country of origin over the office door. His good sense attracted the attention of the telegraph operator, the German émigré Lothario Tugut, who also played the organ for important ceremonies in the cathedral and gave music lessons in the home. Lothario Tugut taught him the Morse code and the workings of the telegraph system, and after only a few lessons on the violin, Florentino Arisa could play by ear like a professional. When he met Fermina Vassa, he was the most sought-after young man in his social circle, the one who knew how to dance the latest dances and recite sentimental poetry by heart, and who was always willing to play violin serenades to his friends' sweethearts. He was very thin, with Indian hair plastered down with scented pomade and eyeglasses for myopia, which added to his forlorn appearance. Aside from his defective vision, he suffered from chronic constipation, which forced him to take enemas throughout his life. He had one black suit, inherited from his dead father, but Tránsito Arisa took such good care of it that every Sunday it looked new. Despite his air of weakness, his reserve, and his somber clothes, the girls in his circle held secret lotteries to determine who would spend time with him, and he gambled on spending time with them until the day he met Fermina Vassa, and his innocence came to an end. He had seen her for the first time one afternoon when Lothario Tugut told him to deliver a telegram to someone named Lorenzo Vassa, with no known place of residence. He found him in one of the oldest houses on the Park of the Evangels. It was half in ruins, and its interior patio, with weeds in the flower pots and a stone fountain with no water, resembled an abbey cloister. Florentino Arisa heard no human sound as he followed the barefoot maid under the arches of the passageway, where unopened moving cartons and bricklayer's tools lay among leftover lime and stacks of cement bags, for the house was undergoing drastic renovation. At the far end of the patio was a temporary office, where a very fat man, whose curly sideburns grew into his mustache, sat behind a desk taking his siesta. In fact, his name was Lorenzo Vassa, and he was not very well known in the city, because he had arrived less than 2 years before and was not a man with many friends. He received the telegram as if it were the continuation of an ominous dream. Florentino Arisa observed his livid eyes with a kind of official compassion. He observed his uncertain fingers trying to break the seal, the heartfelt fear that he had seen so many times in so many addressees who still could not think about telegrams without connecting them with death. After reading it, he regained his composure. He sighed, "Good news." And he handed Florentino Arisa the obligatory 5 reales, letting him know with a relieved smile that he would not have given them to him if the news had been bad. Then he said goodbye with a handshake, which was not the usual thing to do with the telegraph messenger, and the maid accompanied him to the street door, more to keep an eye on him than to lead the way. They retraced their steps along the arcaded passageway. But this time, Florentino Ariza knew that there was someone else in the house, because the brightness in the patio was filled with the voice of a woman repeating a reading lesson. As he passed the sewing room, he saw through the window an older woman and a young girl sitting very close together on two chairs and following the reading in the book that the woman held open on her lap. It seemed a strange sight, the daughter teaching the mother to read. His interpretation was incorrect only in part, because the woman was the aunt, not the mother of the child, although she had raised her as if she were her own. The lesson was not interrupted, but the girl raised her eyes to see who was passing by the window, and that casual glance was the beginning of a cataclysm of love that still had not ended half a century later. All that Florentino Ariza could learn about Lorenzo Daza was that he had come from San Juan de la Cienega with his only daughter and his unmarried sister soon after the cholera epidemic, and those who saw him disembark had no doubt that he had come to stay, since he brought everything necessary for a well-furnished house. His wife had died when the girl was very young. His sister, named Escolastica, was 40 years old, and she was fulfilling a vow to wear the habit of Saint Francis when she went out on the street, and the penitent's rope around her waist when she was at home. The girl was 13 years old, and had the same name as her dead mother, Fermina. It was supposed that Lorenzo Daza was a man of means, because he lived well with no known employment, and had paid hard cash for the park of the Evangel's house, whose restoration must have cost him at least twice the purchase price of 200 gold pesos. His daughter was studying at the Academy of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin, where for two centuries young ladies of society had learned the art and technique of being diligent and submissive wives. During the colonial period and the early years of the Republic, the school had accepted only those students with great family names. But the old families, ruined by independence, had to submit to the realities of a new time, and the academy opened its doors to all applicants who could pay the tuition, regardless of the color of their blood, on the essential condition that they were legitimate daughters of Catholic marriages. In any event, it was an expensive school, and the fact that Fermina Daza studied there was sufficient indication of her family's economic situation, if not of its social position. This news encouraged Florentino Ariza, since it indicated to him that the beautiful adolescent with the almond-shaped eyes was within reach of his dreams. But her father's strict regime soon provided an irremediable difficulty. Unlike the other students, who walked to school in groups or accompanied by an older servant, Fermina Daza always walked with her spinster aunt, and her behavior indicated that she was permitted no distraction. It was in this innocent way that Florentino Ariza began his secret life as a solitary hunter. From 7 o'clock in the morning, he sat on the most hidden bench in the little park, pretending to read a book of verse in the shade of the almond trees, until he saw the impossible maiden walk by in her blue-striped uniform, stockings that reached to her knees, masculine laced oxfords, and a single thick braid with a bow at the end which hung down her back to her waist. She walked with natural haughtiness, her head high, her eyes unmoving, her step rapid, her nose pointing straight ahead, her bag of books held against her chest with crossed arms, her doe's gait making her seem immune to gravity. At her side, struggling to keep up with her, the aunt with the brown habit and rope of St. Francis did not allow him the slightest opportunity to approach. Florentino Ariza saw them pass back and forth 4 times a day and once on Sundays when they came out of high mass, and just seeing the girl was enough for him. Little by little, he idealized her, endowing her with improbable virtues and imaginary sentiments, and after 2 weeks he thought of nothing else but her. So he decided to send Fermina Daza a simple note, written on both sides of the paper in his exquisite notary's hand. But he kept it in his pocket for several days, thinking about how to hand it to her. And while he thought, he wrote several more pages before going to bed, so that the original letter was turning into a dictionary of compliments, inspired by books he had learned by heart because he read them so often during his vigils in the park. Searching for a way to give her the letter, he tried to make the acquaintance of some of the other students at Presentation Academy, but they were too distant from his world. Besides, after much thought, it did not seem prudent to let anyone else know of his intentions. Still, he managed to find out that Fermina Daza had been invited to a Saturday dance a few days after their arrival in the city, and her father had not allowed her to go, with a conclusive, "Everything in due course." By the time the letter contained more than 60 pages written on both sides, Florentino Ariza could no longer endure the weight of his secret, and he unburdened himself to his mother, the only person with whom he allowed himself any confidences. Tránsito Ariza was moved to tears by her son's innocence in matters of love, and she tried to guide him with her own knowledge. She began by convincing him not to deliver the lyrical sheaf of papers, since it would only frighten the girl of his dreams, who, she supposed, was as green as he in matters of the heart. The first step, she said, was to make her aware of his interest, so that his declaration would not take her so much by surprise, and she would have time to think. "But above all," she said, "the first person you have to win over is not the girl, but her aunt." Both pieces of advice were wise, no doubt, but they came too late. In reality, on the day when Fermina Daza let her mind wander for an instant from the reading lesson she was giving her aunt and raised her eyes to see who was walking along the passageway, Florentino Ariza had impressed her because of his air of vulnerability. That night, during supper, her father had mentioned the telegram, which was how she found out why Florentino Ariza had come to the house and what he did for a living. This information increased her interest because for her, as for so many other people at that time, the invention of the telegraph had something magical about it. So that she recognized Florentino Ariza the first time she saw him reading under the trees in the little park, although it in no way disquieted her until her aunt told her he had been there for several weeks. Then when they also saw him on Sundays as they came out of Mass, her aunt was convinced that all these meetings could not be casual. She said, "He is not going to all this trouble for me." For despite her austere conduct and penitential habit, Aunt Escolástica had an instinct for life and a vocation for complicity, which were her greatest virtues, and the mere idea that a man was interested in her niece awakened an irresistible emotion in her. Fermina Daza, however, was still safe from even simple curiosity about love, and the only feeling that Florentino Ariza inspired in her was a certain pity, because it seemed to her that he was sick. But her aunt told her that one had to live a long time to know a man's true nature, and she was convinced that the one who sat in the park to watch them walk by could only be sick with love. Aunt Escolástica was a refuge of understanding and affection for the only child of a loveless marriage. She had raised her since the death of her mother, and in her relations with Lorenzo Daza, she behaved more like an accomplice than an aunt. So that the appearance of Florentino Ariza was, for them, another of the many intimate diversions they invented to pass the time. Four times a day, when they walked through the little park of the Evangels, both hurried to look with a rapid glance at the thin, timid, unimpressive sentinel who was almost always dressed in black despite the heat and who pretended to read under the trees. "There he is," said the one who saw him first, suppressing her laughter, before he raised his eyes and saw the two rigid, aloof women of his life as they crossed the park without looking at him. "Poor thing," her aunt had said. "He does not dare approach you because I am with you. But one day he will, if his intentions are serious, and then he will give you a letter." Foreseeing all kinds of adversities, she taught her to communicate in sign language, an indispensable strategy in forbidden love. These unexpected, almost childish antics caused an unfamiliar curiosity in Fermina Daza. But for several months, It did not occur to her that it could go any further. She never knew when the diversion became a preoccupation and her blood frothed with the need to see him. And one night, she awoke in terror because she saw him looking at her from the darkness at the foot of her bed. Then she longed with all her soul for her aunt's predictions to come true. And in her prayers, she begged God to give him the courage to hand her the letter just so she could know what it said. But her prayers were not answered. On the contrary, this occurred at the time that Florentino Arisa made his confession to his mother, who dissuaded him from handing Fermina Daza his 70 pages of compliments, so that she continued to wait for the rest of the year. Her preoccupation turned into despair as the December vacation approached, and she asked herself over and over again how she would see him and let him see her during the 3 months when she would not be walking to school. Her doubts were still unresolved on Christmas Eve, when she was shaken by the presentiment that he was in the crowd at midnight mass looking at her. And this uneasiness flooded her heart. She did not dare to turn her head, because she was sitting between her father and her aunt, and she had to control herself so that they would not notice her agitation. But in the crowd leaving the church, she felt him so close, so clearly, that an irresistible power forced her to look over her shoulder as she walked along the central nave, and then, a hand's breadth from her eyes, she saw those icy eyes, that livid face, those lips petrified by the terror of love. Dismayed by her own audacity, she seized Aunt Escolastica's arm so she would not fall, and her aunt felt the icy perspiration on her hand through the lace mitt, and she comforted her with an imperceptible sign of unconditional complicity. In the din of fireworks and native drums, of colored lights in the doorways and the clamor of the crowd yearning for peace, Florentino Arisa wandered like a sleepwalker until dawn, watching the fiesta through his tears, dazed by the hallucination that it was he and not God who had been born that night. His delirium increased the following week, when he passed Fermina Daza's house in despair at the siesta hour, and saw that she and her aunt were sitting under the almond trees at the doorway. It was an open-air repetition of the scene he had witnessed the first afternoon in the sewing room. The girl giving a reading lesson to her aunt. But Fermina Daza seemed different without the school uniform, for she wore a narrow tunic with many folds that fell from her shoulders in the Greek style, and on her head she wore a garland of fresh gardenias that made her look like a crowned goddess. Florentino Arisa sat in the park where he was sure he would be seen, and then he did not have recourse to his feigned reading, but sat with the book open and his eyes fixed on the illusory maiden, who did not even respond with a charitable glance. At first he thought that the lesson under the almond trees was a casual innovation, due, perhaps, to the interminable repairs on the house. But in the days that followed, he came to understand that Fermina Daza would be there, within view, every afternoon at the same time during the 3 months of vacation. And that certainty filled him with new hope. He did not have the impression that he was seen. He could not detect any sign of interest or rejection. But in her indifference, there was a distinct radiance that encouraged him to persevere. Then, one afternoon, toward the end of January, the aunt put her work on the chair and left her niece alone in the doorway under the shower of yellow leaves falling from the almond trees. Encouraged by the impetuous thought that this was an arranged opportunity, Florentino Arisa crossed the street and stopped in front of Fermina Daza, so close to her that he could detect the catches in her breathing and the floral scent that he would identify with her for the rest of his life. He spoke with his head high and with a determination that would be his again only half a century later and for the same reason. "All I ask is that you accept a letter from me," he said. It was not the voice that Fermina Daza had expected from him. It was sharp and clear, with a control that had nothing to do with his languid manner. Without lifting her eyes from her embroidery, she replied, "I cannot accept it without my father's permission." Florentino Ariza shuddered at the warmth of that voice, whose hushed tones he was not to forget for the rest of his life. But he held himself steady and replied without hesitation, "Get it." Then he sweetened the command with a plea. "It is a matter of life and death." Fermina Daza did not look at him. She did not interrupt her embroidering, but her decision opened the door a crack, wide enough for the entire world to pass through. "Come back every afternoon," she said to him, "and wait until I change my seat." Florentino Ariza did not understand what she meant until the following Monday when, from the bench in the little park, he saw the same scene with one variation. When Aunt Escolastica went into the house, Fermina Daza stood up and then sat in the other chair. Florentino Ariza, with a white camellia in his lapel, crossed the street and stood in front of her. He said, "This is the greatest moment of my life." Fermina Daza did not raise her eyes to him, but she looked all around her and saw the deserted streets in the heat of the dry season and a swirl of dead leaves pulled along by the wind. "Give it to me," she said. Florentino Ariza had intended to give her the 70 sheets he could recite from memory after reading them so often, but then he decided on a sober and explicit half-page in which he promised only what was essential: his perfect fidelity and his everlasting love. He took the letter out of his inside jacket pocket and held it before the eyes of the troubled embroiderer, who had still not dared to look at him. She saw the blue envelope trembling in a hand petrified with terror, and she raised the embroidery frame so he could put the letter on it, for she could not admit that she had noticed the trembling of his fingers. Then it happened. A bird shook himself among the leaves of the almond trees, and his droppings fell right on the embroidery. Fermina Daza moved the frame out of the way, hid it behind the chair so that he would not notice what had happened, and looked at him for the first time, her face aflame. Florentino Ariza was impassive as he held the letter in his hand and said, "It's good luck." She thanked him with her first smile, and almost snatched the letter away from him, folded it, and hid it in her bodice. Then he offered her the camellia he wore in his lapel. She refused. "It is a flower of promises." Then, conscious that their time was almost over, she again took refuge in her composure. "Now go," she said, "and don't come back until I tell you to." After Florentino Ariza saw her for the first time, his mother knew before he told her, because he lost his voice and his appetite and spent the entire night tossing and turning in his bed. But when he began to wait for the answer to his first letter, his anguish was complicated by diarrhea and green vomit. He became disoriented and suffered from sudden fainting spells, and his mother was terrified because his condition did not resemble the turmoil of love so much as the devastation of cholera. Florentino Ariza's godfather, an old homeopathic practitioner who had been Tránsito Ariza's confidant ever since her days as a secret mistress, was also alarmed at first by the patient's condition, because he had the weak pulse, the hoarse breathing, and the pale perspiration of a dying man. But his examination revealed that he had no fever, no pain anywhere, and that his only concrete feeling was an urgent desire to die. All that was needed was shrewd questioning, first of the patient and then of his mother, to conclude once again that the symptoms of love were the same as those of cholera. He prescribed infusions of linden blossoms to calm the nerves and suggested a change of air so he could find consolation in distance. But Florentino Ariza longed for just the opposite, to enjoy his martyrdom. Tránsito Ariza was a freed quadroon whose instinct for happiness had been frustrated by poverty, and she took pleasure in her son's suffering as if it were her own. She made him drink the infusions when he became delirious, and she smothered him in wool blankets to keep away the chills. But at the same time, she encouraged him to enjoy his prostration. "Take advantage of it now while you are young, and suffer all you can," she said to him, "because these things don't last your whole life." In the postal agency, of course, they did not agree. Florentino Arisa had become negligent, and he was so distracted that he confused the flags that announced the arrival of the mail. And one Wednesday he hoisted the German flag when the ship was from the Leyland Company and carried the mail from Liverpool. And on another day he flew the flag of the United States when the ship was from the Compagnie Générale Transatlantique and carried the mail from Saint-Nazaire. These confusions of love caused such chaos in the distribution of the mail and provoked so many protests from the public that if Florentino Arisa did not lose his job, it was because Lotario Tugut kept him at the telegraph and took him to play the violin in the cathedral choir. They had a friendship difficult to understand because of the difference in their ages, for they might have been grandfather and grandson, but they got along at work as well as they did in the taverns around the port, which were frequented by everyone out for the evening regardless of social class, from drunken beggars to young gentlemen in tuxedos, who fled the gala parties at the social club to eat fried mullet and coconut rice. Lotario Tugut was in the habit of going there after the last shift at the telegraph office, and Dawn often found him drinking Jamaican punch and playing the accordion with the crews of madmen from the Antillean schooners. He was corpulent and bull-necked, with a golden beard and a liberty cap that he wore when he went out at night, and all he needed was a string of bells to look like St. Nicholas. At least once a week, he ended the evening with a little nightbird, as he called him, one of the many who sold emergency love in a transient hotel for sailors. When he met Florentino Arisa, the first thing he did, with a certain magisterial delight, was to initiate him into the secrets of his paradise. He chose for him the little birds he thought best. He discussed their price and style with them, and offered to pay in advance with his own money for their services. But Florentino Arisa did not accept. He was a virgin, and he had decided not to lose his virginity unless it was for love. The hotel was a colonial palace that had seen better days, and its great marble salons and rooms were divided into plasterboard cubicles with peepholes, which were rented out as much for watching as for doing. There was talk of busybodies who had their eyes poked out with knitting needles, of a man who recognized his own wife as the woman he was spying on, of well-bred gentlemen who came disguised as tarts to forget who they were with the bosuns on shore leave, and of so many other misadventures of observers and observed that the mere idea of going into the next room terrified Florentino Arisa. And so Lotario Tugut could never persuade him that watching and letting himself be watched were the refinements of European princes. As opposed to what his corpulence might suggest, Lotario Tugut had the rosebud genitals of a cherub. But this must have been a fortunate defect, because the most tarnished birds argued over who would have the chance to go to bed with him. And then they shrieked as if their throats were being cut, shaking the buttresses of the palace and making its ghosts tremble in fear. They said he used an ointment made of snake venom that inflamed women's loins, but he swore he had no resources other than those that God had given him. He would say with uproarious laughter, "It's pure love!" Many years had to pass before Florentino Arisa would understand that perhaps he was right. He was convinced at last, at a more advanced stage of his sentimental education, when he met a man who lived like a king by exploiting three women at the same time. The three of them rendered their accounts at dawn, prostrate at his feet to beg forgiveness for their meager profits, and the only gratification they sought was that he go to bed with the one who brought him the most money. Florentino Arisa thought that terror alone could induce such indignities, but one of the three girls surprised him with the contradictory truth. "These are things," she said, "you do only for love." It was not so much for his talents as a fornicator as for his personal charm that Lothario Tugut had become one of the most esteemed clients of the hotel. Florentino Arisa, because he was so quiet and elusive, also earned the esteem of the owner, and during the most arduous period of his grief, he would lock himself in the suffocating little rooms to read verses and tearful, serialized love stories, and his reveries left nests of dark swallows on the balconies, and the sound of kisses and the beating of wings in the stillness of siesta. At dusk, when it was cooler, it was impossible not to listen to the conversations of men who came to console themselves at the end of their day with hurried love. So that Florentino Arisa heard about many acts of disloyalty, and even some state secrets, which important clients and even local officials confided to their ephemeral lovers, not caring if they could be overheard in the adjoining rooms. This was also how he learned that 4 nautical leagues to the north of the Sotavento archipelago, a Spanish galleon had been lying underwater since the 18th century, with its cargo of more than 500 billion pesos in pure gold and precious stones. The story astounded him, but he did not think of it again until a few months later, when his love awakened in him an overwhelming desire to salvage the sunken treasure so that Fermina Daza could bathe in showers of gold. Years later, when he tried to remember what the maiden idealized by the alchemy of poetry really was like, he could not distinguish her from the heart-rending twilights of those times. Even when he observed her, unseen, during those days of longing, when he waited for a reply to his first letter, he saw her transfigured in the afternoon shimmer of 2 o'clock in a shower of blossoms from the almond trees, where it was always April, regardless of the season of the year. The only reason he was interested in accompanying Lothario Tugut on his violin, from the privileged vantage point in the choir, was to see how her tunic fluttered in the breeze raised by the canticles. But his own delirium finally interfered with that pleasure, for the mystic music seemed so innocuous compared with the state of his soul that he attempted to make it more exciting with love waltzes, and Lothario Tugut found himself obliged to ask that he leave the choir. This was the time when he gave in to his desire to eat the gardenias that Tránsito Arisa grew in pots in the patio, so that he could know the taste of Fermina Daza. It was also the time when he happened to find in one of his mother's trunks a liter bottle of the cologne that the sailors from the Hamburg American line sold as contraband, and he could not resist the temptation to sample it, in order to discover other tastes of his beloved. He continued to drink from the bottle until dawn, and he became drunk on Fermina Daza in abrasive swallows, first in the taverns around the port, and then as he stared out to sea from the jetties, where lovers without a roof over their heads made consoling love, until at last he succumbed to unconsciousness. Tránsito Arisa, who had waited for him until 6 o'clock in the morning with her heart in her mouth, searched for him in the most improbable hiding places, and a short while after noon she found him wallowing in a pool of fragrant vomit in a cove of the bay where drowning victims washed ashore. She took advantage of the hiatus of his convalescence to reproach him for his passivity as he waited for the answer to his letter. She reminded him that the weak would never enter the kingdom of love, which is a harsh and ungenerous kingdom, and that women give themselves only to men of resolute spirit, who provide the security they need in order to face life. Florentino Arisa learned the lesson, perhaps too well. Tránsito Arisa could not hide a feeling of pride, more carnal than maternal, when she saw him leave the notions shop in his black suit and stiff felt hat, his lyrical bow tie and celluloid collar, and she asked him as a joke if he was going to a funeral. He answered, his ears flaming, "It's almost the same thing." She realized that he could hardly breathe with fear, but his determination was invincible. She gave him her final warnings and her blessing, and laughing for all she was worth, she promised him another bottle of cologne so they could celebrate his victory together. He had given Fermina Dasa the letter a month before, and since then he had often broken his promise not to return to the little park, but he had been very careful not to be seen. Nothing had changed. The reading lesson under the trees ended at about 2 o'clock, when the city was waking from its siesta, and Fermina Dasa embroidered with her aunt until the day began to cool. Florentino Arisa did not wait for the aunt to go into the house, and he crossed the street with a martial stride that allowed him to overcome the weakness in his knees. But he spoke to her aunt, not to Fermina Dasa.
"Please be so kind as to leave me alone for a moment with the young lady," he said. "I have something important to tell her."
"What impertinence!" her aunt said to him.
"There is nothing that has to do with her that I cannot hear."
"Then I will not say anything to her," he said. "But I warn you that you will be responsible for the consequences."
That was not the manner Escolastica Dasa expected from the ideal sweetheart. But she stood up in alarm because, for the first time, she had the overwhelming impression that Florentino Arisa was speaking under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So she went into the house to change needles and left the two young people alone under the almond trees in the doorway. In reality, Fermina Dasa knew very little about this taciturn suitor who had appeared in her life like a winter swallow, and whose name she would not even have known if it had not been for his signature on the letter. She had learned that he was the fatherless son of an unmarried woman, who was hard-working and serious, but forever marked by the fiery stigma of her single youthful mistake. She had learned that he was not a messenger, as she had supposed, but a well-qualified assistant with a promising future. And she thought that he had delivered the telegram to her father only as a pretext for seeing her. This idea moved her. She also knew that he was one of the musicians in the choir, and although she never dared raise her eyes to look at him during Mass, she had the revelation one Sunday that while the other instruments played for everyone, the violin played for her alone. He was not the kind of man she would have chosen. His foundling's eyeglasses, his clerical garb, his mysterious resources had awakened in her a curiosity that was difficult to resist. But she had never imagined that curiosity was one of the many masks of love. She herself could not explain why she had accepted the letter. She did not reproach herself for doing so, but the ever-increasing pressure to respond complicated her life. Her father's every word, his casual glances, his most trivial gestures, seemed set with traps to uncover her secret. Her state of alarm was such that she avoided speaking at the table for fear some slip might betray her, and she became evasive even with her aunt Escolastica, who nonetheless shared her repressed anxiety as if it were her own. She would lock herself in the bathroom at odd hours, and for no reason other than to reread the letter, attempting to discover a secret code, a magic formula hidden in one of the 314 letters of its 58 words, in the hope that they would tell her more than they said. But all she found was what she had understood on first reading, when she ran to lock herself in the bathroom, her heart in a frenzy, and tore open the envelope, hoping for a long, feverish letter, and found only a perfumed note whose determination frightened her. At first she had not even thought seriously that she was obliged to respond, but the letter was so explicit that there was no way to avoid it. Meanwhile, in the torment of her doubts, she was surprised to find herself thinking about Florentino Arisa with more frequency and interest than she cared to allow. And she even asked herself, in great distress, why he was not in the little park at the usual hour, forgetting that it was she who had asked him not to return while she was preparing her reply. And so she thought about him as she never could have imagined thinking about anyone, having premonitions that he would be where he was not, wanting him to be where he could not be, awakening with a start, with the physical sensation that he was looking at her in the darkness while she slept, so that on the afternoon when she heard his resolute steps on the yellow leaves in the little park, it was difficult for her not to think this was yet another trick of her imagination.
But when he demanded her answer with an authority that was so different from his languor, she managed to overcome her fear and tried to dodge the issue with the truth. She did not know how to answer him. But Florentino Ariza had not leapt across an abyss only to be shooed away with such excuses.
"If you accepted the letter," he said to her, "it shows a lack of courtesy not to answer it."
That was the end of the labyrinth. Fermina Daza regained her self-control, begged his pardon for the delay, and gave him her solemn word that he would have an answer before the end of the vacation. And he did. On the last Friday in February, 3 days before school reopened, Aunt Escolástica went to the telegraph office to ask how much it cost to send a telegram to Piedras de Moler, a village that did not even appear on the list of places served by the telegraph, and she allowed Florentino Ariza to attend her as if she had never seen him before. But when she left, she pretended to forget a breviary covered in lizard skin, leaving it on the counter, and in it there was an envelope made of linen paper with golden vignettes. Delirious with joy, Florentino Ariza spent the rest of the afternoon eating roses and reading the note letter by letter, over and over again, and the more he read, the more roses he ate. And by midnight, he had read it so many times and had eaten so many roses that his mother had to hold his head as if he were a calf and force him to swallow a dose of castor oil. It was the year they fell into devastating love. Neither one could do anything except think about the other, dream about the other, and wait for letters with the same impatience they felt when they answered them. Never in that delirious spring, or in the following year, did they have the opportunity to speak to each other. Moreover, from the moment they saw each other for the first time until he reiterated his determination a half-century later, they never had the opportunity to be alone or to talk of their love. But during the first 3 months, not one day went by that they did not write to each other, and for a time they wrote twice a day, until Aunt Escolástica became frightened by the intensity of the blaze that she herself had helped to ignite. After the first letter that she carried to the telegraph office, with an ember of revenge against her own destiny, she had allowed an almost daily exchange of messages in what appeared to be casual encounters on the street. But she did not have the courage to permit a conversation, no matter how banal and fleeting it might be. Still, after 3 months, she realized that her niece was not the victim of a girlish fancy, as it had seemed at first, and that her own life was threatened by the fire of love. The truth was that Escolástica Daza had no other means of support except her brother's charity, and she knew that his tyrannical nature would never forgive such a betrayal of his confidence. But when it was time for the final decision, she did not have the heart to cause her niece the same irreparable grief that she had been obliged to nurture ever since her youth, and she permitted her to use a strategy that allowed her the illusion of innocence. The method was simple. Fermina Daza would leave her letter in some hiding place along her daily route from the house to the academy, and in that letter she would indicate to Florentino Ariza where she expected to find his answer. Florentino Ariza did the same. In this way, for the rest of the year, the conflicts in Aunt Escolastica's conscience were transferred to baptistries in churches, holes in trees, and crannies in ruined colonial fortresses. Sometimes their letters were soaked by rain, soiled by mud, torn by adversity, and some were lost for a variety of other reasons, but they always found a way to be in touch with each other again. Florentino Ariza wrote every night. Letter by letter, he had no mercy as he poisoned himself with the smoke from the palm oil lamps in the back room of the notion shop, and his letters became more discursive and more lunatic the more he tried to imitate his favorite poets from the popular library, which even at that time was approaching 80 volumes. His mother, who had urged him with so much fervor to enjoy his torment, became concerned for his health.
"You are going to wear out your brains,"
she shouted at him from the bedroom when she heard the first rooster's crow. No woman is worth all that. She could not remember ever having known anyone in such a state of unbridled passion. But he paid no attention to her. Sometimes he went to the office without having slept, his hair in an uproar of love after leaving the letter in the prearranged hiding place so that Fermina Daza would find it on her way to school. She, on the other hand, under the watchful eye of her father and the vicious spying of the nuns, could barely manage to fill half a page from her notebook when she locked herself in the bathroom or pretended to take notes in class. But this was not only due to her limited time and the danger of being taken by surprise. It was also her nature that caused her letters to avoid emotional pitfalls and confine themselves to relating the events of her daily life in the utilitarian style of a ship's log. In reality, they were distracted letters, intended to keep the coals alive without putting her hand in the fire, while Florentino Ariza burned himself alive in every line. Desperate to infect her with his own madness, he sent her miniaturist verses inscribed with the point of a pin on camellia petals. It was he, not she, who had the audacity to enclose a lock of his hair in one letter. But he never received the response he longed for, which was an entire strand of Fermina Daza's braid. He did move her at last to take one step further, and from that time on, she began to send him the veins of leaves dried in dictionaries, the wings of butterflies, the feathers of magic birds, and for his birthday, she gave him a square centimeter of St. Peter Claver's habit, which in those days was being sold in secret at a price far beyond the reach of a schoolgirl her age. One night, without any warning, Fermina Daza awoke with a start. A solo violin was serenading her, playing the same waltz over and over again. She shuddered when she realized that each note was an act of thanksgiving for the petals from her herbarium, for the moments stolen from arithmetic to write her letters, for her fear of examinations when she was thinking more about him than about the natural sciences. But she did not dare believe that Florentino Ariza was capable of such imprudence. The next morning at breakfast, Lorenzo Daza could not contain his curiosity. First, because he did not know what playing a single piece meant in the language of serenades, and second, because, despite the attention with which he had listened, he could not determine which house it had been intended for. Aunt Escolastica, with a sang-froid that took her niece's breath away, stated that she had seen through the bedroom curtains that the solitary violinist was standing on the other side of the park, and she said that in any event, a single piece was notification of severed relations. In that day's letter, Florentino Ariza confirmed that he had played the serenade, that he had composed the waltz, and that it bore the name he called Fermina Daza in his heart, the Crowned Goddess. He did not play it in the park again, but on moonlit nights in places chosen so that she could listen without fear in her bedroom. One of his favorite spots was the Pauper's Cemetery, exposed to the sun and the rain on an indigent hill where turkey buzzards dozed and the music achieved a supernatural resonance. Later he learned to recognize the direction of the winds, and in this way he was certain that his melody carried as far as it had to. In August of that year, a new civil war, one of the many that had been devastating the country for over half a century, threatened to spread, and the government imposed martial law and a 6 o'clock curfew in the provinces along the Caribbean coast. Although some disturbances had already occurred, and the troops had committed all kinds of retaliatory abuses, Florentino Ariza was so befuddled that he was unaware of the state of the world, and a military patrol surprised him one dawn as he disturbed the chastity of the dead with his amorous provocations. By some miracle, he escaped summary execution after he was accused of being a spy who sent messages in the key of G to the liberal ships marauding in nearby waters. "What the hell do you mean, a spy?" said Florentino Ariza. "I'm nothing but a poor lover." For 3 nights he slept with irons around his ankles in the cells of the local garrison, But when he was released, he felt defrauded by the brevity of his captivity. And even in the days of his old age, when so many other wars were confused in his memory, he still thought he was the only man in the city, and perhaps the country, who had dragged 5-pound leg irons for the sake of love. Their frenetic correspondence was almost 2 years old when Florentino Arisa, in a letter of only one paragraph, made a formal proposal of marriage to Fermina Daza. On several occasions during the preceding 6 months, he had sent her a white camellia, but she would return it to him in her next letter so that he would have no doubt that she was disposed to continue writing to him, but without the seriousness of an engagement. The truth is that she had always taken the comings and goings of the camellia as a lover's game, and it had never occurred to her to consider it as a crossroads in her destiny. But when the formal proposal arrived, she felt herself wounded for the first time by the clawings of death. Panic-stricken, she told her aunt Escolastica, who gave her advice with the courage and lucidity she had not had when she was 20 and was forced to decide her own fate. "Tell him yes," she said, "even if you are dying of fear, even if you are sorry later, because whatever you do, you will be sorry all the rest of your life if you say no." Fermina Daza, however, was so confused that she asked for some time to think it over. First she asked for a month, then two, then three. And when the fourth month had ended and she still had not replied, she received a white camellia again, not alone in the envelope as on other occasions, but with the peremptory notification that this was the last one. It was now or never. Then that same afternoon, it was Florentino Arisa who saw the face of death when he received an envelope containing a strip of paper torn from the margin of a school notebook on which a one-line answer was written in pencil. "Very well. I will marry you if you promise not to make me eat eggplant." Florentino Arisa was not prepared for that answer, but his mother was. Since he had first spoken to her 6 months earlier about his intention to marry, Tránsito Arisa had begun negotiations for renting the entire house which, until that time, she had shared with two other families. A two-story structure dating from the 17th century, it was the building where the tobacco monopoly had been located under Spanish rule, and its ruined owners had been obliged to rent it out in bits and pieces because they did not have the money to maintain it. It had one section facing the street where the retail tobacco shop had been, another section at the rear of a paved patio where the factory had been located, and a very large stable that the current tenants used in common for washing and drying their clothes. Tránsito Arisa occupied the first section, which was the most convenient and the best preserved, although it was also the smallest. The notion store was in the old tobacco shop, with a large door facing the street, and to one side was the former storeroom, with only a skylight for ventilation, where Tránsito Arisa slept. The stockroom took up half the space that was divided by a wooden partition. In it were a table and four chairs, used for both eating and writing, and it was there that Florentino Arisa hung his hammock when dawn did not find him writing. It was a good space for the two of them, but too small for a third person, least of all a young lady from the Academy of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin, whose father had restored a house in ruins until it was like new, while the families with seven titles went to bed with the fear that the roofs of their mansions would cave in on them while they slept. So Tránsito Arisa had arranged with the owner to let her also occupy the gallery in the patio, and in exchange she would keep the house in good condition for 5 years. She had the resources to do so. In addition to the cash income from the notion store and the hemostatic rags, which sufficed for her modest life, she had multiplied her savings by lending them to a clientele made up of the embarrassed new poor, who accepted her excessive interest rates for the sake of her discretion. Ladies with the airs of queens descended from their carriages at the entrance to the notion shop, unencumbered by nursemaids or servants, and as they pretended to buy Holland laces and passementerie trimmings, they pawned, between sobs, the last glittering ornaments of their lost paradise. Tránsito Arisa rescued them from difficulties with so much consideration for their lineage that many of them left more grateful for the honor than for the favor they had received. In less than 10 years, she knew the jewels, so often redeemed and then tearfully pawned again as if they had been her own. And at the time her son decided to marry, the profits, converted into gold, lay hidden in a clay jar under her bed. Then she did her accounts and discovered not only that she could undertake to keep the rented house standing for 5 years, but that with the same shrewdness and a little more luck, she could perhaps buy it, before she died, for the 12 grandchildren she hoped to have. Florentino Arisa, for his part, had received provisional appointment as first assistant at the telegraph office, and Lotario Tugut wanted him to head the office when he left to direct the School of Telegraphy and Magnetism, which he expected to do the following year. So the practical side of the marriage was resolved. Still, Tránsito Arisa thought that two final conditions were prudent. The first was to find out who Lorenzo Daza really was, for though his accent left no doubt concerning his origins, no one had any certain information as to his identity and livelihood. The second was that the engagement be a long one, so that the fiancés could come to know each other person to person, and that the strictest reserve be maintained until both felt very certain of their affections. She suggested they wait until the war was over. Florentino Arisa agreed to absolute secrecy, not only for his mother's reasons, but because of the hermeticism of his own character. He also agreed to the delay, but its terms seemed unrealistic to him, since in over half a century of independent life, the nation had not had a single day of civil peace. "We'll grow old waiting," he said. His godfather, the homeopathic practitioner, who happened to be taking part in the conversation, did not believe that the wars were an obstacle. He thought they were nothing more than the struggles of the poor, driven like oxen by the landowners, against barefoot soldiers, who were driven in turn by the government. "The war is in the mountains," he said. "For as long as I can remember, they have killed us in the cities with decrees, not with bullets." In any case, the details of the engagement were settled in their letters during the weeks that followed. Fermina Daza, on the advice of her aunt Escolástica, accepted both the 2-year extension and the condition of absolute secrecy, and suggested that Florentino Arisa ask for her hand when she finished secondary school during the Christmas vacation. When the time came, they would decide on how the engagement was to be formalized, depending on the degree of approval she obtained from her father. In the meantime, they continued to write to each other with the same ardor and frequency, but free of the turmoil they had felt before, and their letters tended toward a domestic tone that seemed appropriate to husband and wife. Nothing disturbed their dreams. Florentino Arisa's life had changed. Requited love had given him a confidence and strength he had never known before, and he was so efficient in his work that Lotario Tugut had no trouble having him named his permanent assistant. By that time, his plans for the School of Telegraphy and Magnetism had failed, and the German dedicated his free time to the only thing he really enjoyed, going to the port to play the accordion and drink beer with the sailors, finishing the evening at the Transient Hotel. It was a long time before Florentino Arisa realized that Lotario Tugut's influence in the Palace of Pleasure was due to the fact that he had become the owner of the establishment, as well as impresario for the birds in the port. He had bought it gradually with his savings of many years, but the person who ran it for him was a lean, one-eyed little man with a polished head and a heart so kind that no one understood how he could be such a good manager. But he was. At least it seemed that way to Florentino Arisa when the manager told him, without his requesting it, that he had the permanent use of a room in the hotel, not only to resolve problems of the lower belly whenever he decided to do so, but so that he could have at his disposal a quiet place for his reading and his love letters. And as the long months passed until the formalizing of the engagement, he spent more time there than at the office or his house, and there were periods when Tránsito Arisa saw him only when he came home to change his clothes. Reading had become his insatiable vice. Ever since she had taught him to read, his mother had bought him illustrated books by Nordic authors, which were sold as stories for children, but in reality were the cruelest and most perverse that one could read at any age. When he was 5 years old, Florentino Arisa would recite them from memory, both in his classes and at literary evenings at school. But his familiarity with them did not alleviate the terror they caused. On the contrary, it became acute. So that when he began to read poetry, by comparison, it was like finding an oasis. Even during his adolescence, he had devoured, in the order of their appearance, all the volumes of the popular library that Tránsito Arisa bought from the bargain booksellers at the Arcade of the Scribes, where one could find everything from Homer to the least meritorious of the local poets. But he made no distinctions. He read whatever came his way, as if it had been ordained by fate. And despite his many years of reading, he still could not judge what was good and what was not in all that he had read. The only thing clear to him was that he preferred verse to prose, and in verse he preferred love poems that he memorized without even intending to after the second reading, and the better rhymed and metered they were, and the more heart-rending, the more easily he learned them. They were the original source of his first letters to Fermina Daza, those half-baked endearments taken whole from the Spanish Romantics, and his letters continued in that vein until real life obliged him to concern himself with matters more mundane than heartache. By that time he had moved on to tearful, serialized novels and other, even more profane prose of the day. He had learned to cry with his mother as they read the pamphlets by local poets that were sold in plazas and arcades for 2 centavos each. But at the same time, he was able to recite from memory the most exquisite Castilian poetry of the Golden Age. In general, he read everything that fell into his hands in the order in which it fell, so that long after those hard years of his first love, when he was no longer young, he would read from first page to last the 20 volumes of the Young People's Treasury, the complete catalogues of the Garnier Brothers classics in translation, and the simplest works that Don Vicente Blasco Ibáñez published in the Prometeo collection. In any event, his youthful adventures in the transient hotel were not limited to reading and composing feverish letters, but also included his initiation into the secrets of loveless love. Life in the house began after noon, when his friends, the birds, got up as bare as the day they were born, so that when Florentino Arisa arrived after work, he found a palace populated by naked nymphs who shouted their commentaries on the secrets of the city, which they knew because of the faithlessness of the protagonists. Many displayed in their nudity traces of their past, scars of knife thrusts in the belly, starbursts of gunshot wounds, ridges of the razor cuts of love, cesarean sections sewn up by butchers. Some of them had their young children with them during the day, those unfortunate fruits of youthful defiance or carelessness, and they took off their children's clothes as soon as they were brought in, so they would not feel different in that paradise of nudity. Each one cooked her own food, and no one ate better than Florentino Arisa when they invited him for a meal, because he chose the best from each. It was a daily fiesta that lasted until dusk, when the naked women marched singing toward the bathrooms, asked to borrow soap, toothbrushes, scissors, cut each other's hair, dressed in borrowed clothes, painted themselves like lugubrious clowns, and went out to hunt the first prey of the night. Then life in the house became impersonal and dehumanized, and it was impossible to share in it without paying. Since he had known Fermina Daza, there was no place where Florentino Arisa felt more at ease because it was the only place where he felt that he was with her. Perhaps it was for similar reasons that an elegant older woman with beautiful silvery hair lived there, but did not participate in the uninhibited life of the naked women, who professed sacramental respect for her. A premature sweetheart had taken her there when she was young, and after enjoying her for a time, abandoned her to her fate. Nevertheless, despite the stigma, she had made a good marriage. When she was quite old and alone, two sons and three daughters argued over who would have the pleasure of taking her to live with them. But she could not think of a better place to live than that hotel of her youthful debaucheries. Her permanent room was her only home, and this made for immediate communion with Florentino Arisa, who, she said, would become a wise man known throughout the world because he could enrich his soul with reading in a paradise of salaciousness. Florentino Arisa, for his part, developed so much affection for her that he helped her with her shopping and would spend the afternoons in conversation with her. He thought she was a woman wise in the ways of love, since she offered many insights into his affair without his having to reveal any secrets to her. If he had not given in to the many temptations at hand before he experienced Fermina Vassa's love, he certainly would not succumb now that she was his official betrothed. So Florentino Arisa lived with the girls and shared their pleasures and miseries, but it did not occur to him or them to go any further. An unforeseen event demonstrated the severity of his determination. One afternoon at 6 o'clock, when the girls were dressing to receive that evening's clients, the woman who cleaned the rooms on his floor in the hotel came into his cubicle. She was young, but haggard and old before her time, like a fully dressed penitent surrounded by glorious nakedness. He saw her every day without feeling himself observed. She walked through the rooms with her brooms, a bucket for the trash, and a special rag for picking up used condoms from the floor. She came into the room where Florentino Arisa lay reading, and as always, she cleaned with great care so as not to disturb him. Then she passed close to the bed, and he felt a warm and tender hand low